Well, I appreciate the invitation to do this. I plan on staying here the rest of the time and try to learn something, because, like you said, there's a lot we don't know. So anyway, we do have some success stories in the Northern Plains, so I want to share some of those with you and some of the thoughts about, I think, where I might go with this, where we might go with this as time goes on. You know, we've been expecting remote sensing to solve all our problems since the 70s, but due to lack of analysis tools and all kinds of other factors, it's only been until recently we've been able to really make some sense out of this and try to get some real practical value out of it. So there's two strategies, I guess, that at least I've used, and some of you have used, and others have used, and that's to use an image as a kind of a template to base further sampling on, to try to reduce the work that's involved in getting other data. And then the holy grail, I guess, is to use the image to directly relate to rates, and somewhat like the Oklahoma State, the NTEC spray-on-the-go type machines go. So that's what we'd really like to do as we all age and farms get bigger and challenges get bigger. And then recently, these active sensors that Kyle was talking about have been tested. Important part of this research has been the incorporation, I think, of a non-nitrogen limiting test area. Some of you remember the days, and I know Jim does, that where we used to paint plywood and stick them out on the edges of the field so that we can compare the light that we're getting to the color on the plywood, and had to be a specific color of paint and all that stuff. I mean, how many farmers would ever do that? Like -2. All right. So right now, the idea is to have the enhanced rate and then a base rate in the rest of the field. So just some kind of a small strip, something that can be detected, and then reference that somehow. So I want to talk mostly about the North Dakota work and about the direct and indirect approaches, because I think, you know, it wasn't anything that any of us did individually, some great genius or anything, but it was just a combination of, I think, the kind of farmers we have and the kind of crops that we grow and just everything coming together at the same time that was very helpful. So the crop that has been most successful in, and people use it most, is sugar beets, and I'll show you, I think, a harvest here in a little bit. But the income that comes off a sugar beet has to do with both its yield and then also the sugar content and the impurities that are in the beets. And then all three of those things have to be optimized in order for the income off the sugar beets to be the greatest. And nitrogen is a huge driver of that. So early in the season, there needs to be enough nitrogen around for the beets to grow and to be healthy and to have good-sized roots of a good shape like this, so they can be popped out of ground with mechanical equipment at harvest time. But then it's been known for a long time that excess nitrogen leads to impurities like amino N that makes processing really expensive. And excess N means that the plant puts a lot more energy into making this green stuff up here, which farmers in the Northern Plains just mulch and put back on the field. I know some people harvest it in other parts of the world for animal feed, and so maybe that's not as big a deal, but in our area it's just kind of wasteful for the plant to be making green stuff when it's really supposed to be making sugar. So we've known about this for about 100 years. The first paper I found, anyway, is by Head in 1912, and there's a whole series of papers after that it confirmed about the more nitrogen you have, the lower sugar content you have, and the balance between the yield and the sugar content. This is just one little study about 40 years ago or so in southeast North Dakota, where with increasing N rate, we have increasing root yield, but see how it kind of slacks off as we get to the really high N rates. And then the sugar content successively declines, and so the sugar yield, which is actually what the farmer gets paid for, maxes out at these modest N levels, and then the impurity keeps going up too. So the cost of refining that goes up, the sugar content as a whole goes down, and farmer's income goes down, even though he's putting more inputs in it. So I think that's where we've made some strides. And so people were kind of at a loss before maybe the 60s, 70s. on how to get a handle on this, because there were some residual things that were going on in the field they couldn't really explain, and then the idea of the soil testing to a depth came about first in barley in 63, and then a series of experiments, Colorado State. Joe Giles, who's recently retired from NDSU, did his PhD work there and saw that soil testing for nitrates was really, really important for the long-term, within a rotation, beet optimization. John Morgan, also recently retired from our department, said in an article in 1980 that now the Red River Valley widely practices soil testing, and they soil test down to 4 feet regularly, so it's quite the process. So initially, 2 feet, 60 centimeters, and then down to 120 centimeters, and then a series of studies in some really poor growing beet areas. One of them I worked in about 10 years ago or so found that even sampling down to 180 centimeters was necessary to kind of explain to growers that they needed to ease up a little bit on their nitrogen and their rotations. So this is a beet harvest in North Dakota, Minnesota, many places in the country. So ahead of the harvester, this is the harvester here, pops the beets out of the ground, puts in a basket, there's a wheel that comes around, and a truck some kind is deposited in there, goes to the processing plant or piling station where they kind of go in cold storage for a while. But this is the defoliator that comes in ahead of it. They usually don't go much farther ahead of the harvester than maybe about an hour or so, because you don't want them to get hot, cold. You don't want any greenness. You don't want to be rain out of the field. So right ahead of the harvester, the defoliator is mulching this greenness, and so it's going back in the field. And so it gives a person an opportunity. You got all this greenness out in the field. There's places in the world that people call this green manure, and that's really kind of what it is. But we really didn't think about it until maybe 15, 20 years ago in North Dakota. But people in other parts of the world have been thinking about it for a long time. The first reference that I know of is by a couple of French researchers back in 1967. They had a four-year rotation. I don't know French, but I translated this paper. But anyway, four-year rotation with beets and small grains in France. Really nice study, and they found that at the study that it contributed about 40 kilograms per hectare of nitrogen to the subsequent crop. So that was kind of the start, and then we've all built on that knowledge since then. There are a series of studies that showed that, the nitrogen contribution following the sugar beets actually came from the tops and not from other things. And then we started to have these little inferences from John Morgan and from others that there really were some differences in the growth of the subsequent crops based on the color of the sugar beet tops the year before. So this is some work when we started work with satellite imagery and with aerial photography and different sensors, and some work that showed that if we put on, harvested the tops, the really high-end tops, the really, really green, really lush, up to your elbows type sugar beet tops, and laid them down for the next year, that there was almost 300 kilograms per hectare of nitrogen in those, where the low nitrogen tops, the pretty short, pretty yellow sugar beet tops didn't contain all that much of it at all. So that gave us an opportunity to look at sugar beet tops and sensing as a contribution against the nitrogen from the next year, which is substantial. The cost of nitrogen then and the cost of nitrogen now, it's a great economic importance to people to know that happens. So a series of studies, we could use the photography, we could use some satellite imagery in the work we did and work that Morgan did, and the Landsat 5, 7 was what was used. And we classified things into, green, yellow, green, and yellow. And if you look at our nitrogen recommendations to this day and our previous crop credits, we give a different credit for each one of those greenness indices. We had some poor quality beets up in the northeast part of the state, up near Canada, in potato production country, where people really poured the nitrogen on for potatoes, and then it leached down. It was a fine sandy loam soil, so it would leach. They grow a crop of wheat the next year maybe, and then the beets would get into that real deep nitrogen that leached down there, and they were big as pumpkins and leaves as tall as your armpits, and the sugar content was miserably low. So we found that in those areas you really need to sample deep, and you need to really give a credit to that nitrogen that's going back to the soil, which they hadn't done before. And after a few years, they cleaned it up. It's productive just like the rest of the districts are. So this is the kind of work we did. This is Landsat. This is just an aerial photography, and we were able to extract those out. It's harder to see on these kind of pictures, but these are the application maps we gave to the farmer, and they really helped him, what we call, evening out the field, or at least a decrease in the areas of the field that had poor quality beets as you went through the rotation. So we used those credits. It was really kind of a hard sell. This is a back and forth between the farmers and ourselves. We'd have meetings every year, and the farmers the first year said we were nuts. And, then after another year, they said, well, maybe you know what you're talking about a little bit. And it was after about 3 years or so of back and forth and different kind of experiments before they were really convinced that this is what they wanted to do. And this was very convincing for them to go out in the field and actually put those rates on. In areas we thought needed a big credit, they say, you're not going to get any wheat off of that. We got just as good a wheat and good protein off of those areas that we reduced the N due to the greenness of the sugar beet tops and those that we didn't have to reduce it at all. So that was pretty convincing after they saw that reducing those rates. We actually had one field that we had areas of the field we didn't put any nitrogen on at all, and they just shook their heads, but it was just as good as the rest of the field. So they thought, well, okay, maybe this is really going to work. So it really works. So the adoption has been very good of this satellite imagery. This is some American crystal sugar data from 2002. This is reproduced off an IPNI article from this last year into metric. In 2002, somewhere around 15,000 hectares, and then 2009, somewhere around 63,000 hectares, which I think is somewhere in the neighborhood of 50%. The growers now use this, which is, substantial. So, the one drawback of the thing, if there is drawback, is that the satellite imagery themselves really doesn't give the green, yellow thing. So we know it's kind of divided into really lush growth, not quite so lush growth, and really kind of poor growth, or just background growth. So then the agriculturalists take those pictures from various townships, and they go out to areas to ground truth it, and then they say that these wavelengths or this color is the green, this is the yellow green, and then they can incorporate into that GIS mode and send that back to the farmers. This is the profitability of it, revenue per hectare. This again from American Crystal Sugar, which is our largest co-op in the area. Here we have anything that's managed through zones, through the satellite image. We have greater refinable sugar, which is a very good thing. Then we have, this is per ton of beets and megagrams here. Of beets, and this is per unit area, and then this is the revenue per hectare in U.S. dollars. So they're making, people that use the satellite image are generally making about $90 per hectare above, which is, people that have 1,000, 5,000 acres of beets, that's a lot of money. So that's why people are using it. We can also use this in an indirect approach. We use it for the credits, but then we can also use it in order to direct the soil sampling to other crops too, because those zones tend to be stable over time. These are zones generated in 1997 in a potato image, and here's this kind of a V-shaped thing up here, and some relatively high-end tops up here, and low-end tops here and here. And in 1999, in the wheat, low-end tops here and here, and high-end tops here and here. So the same kind of patterns are shown year after year after year because of drainage, because of soils, because of whatever else is logical out there that's making this work. So we use it for soil sampling to other crops, even for different nutrients and nitrogen. A lot of it is topography-driven, even in the valley, where you can see the curvature of the earth. There are still bumps out there that make huge differences in soil properties. So when we talk about topography in the valley, people laugh because they say there isn't any, but I argue that there is some, and it makes a huge difference in soil properties. All right, so one of the things we've also seen is that when we're using the zone to direct the soil sampling for nitrogen or other nutrients, using more than one tool is better than just using one by itself. And this is an example on one of our out of the valley areas where we have a topography and soil EC. We add the satellite imagery to it, and we can increase the knowledge we have about the field with it. So even outside the area where we don't have beets anymore, and we're in a corn and soybean or a wheat and sunflower, canola rotation, we still see the satellite imagery is valuable layer of information to direct our zone management of nutrients. This is some from Minot, which certainly doesn't grow sugar beets, and the satellite images here, 2001, 2003, very, very much related to the soil nitrate content. And then topography satellite image with the EC, really, really good correlations. Anytime, if you've been in precision ag work at all, nutrients, anytime you get above an R of 0.4, you've hit a home run. So this is kind of like a Babe Ruth home run over here. So it's good. So in our three-state study, we had a three-state study, many fields and Montana sites and Minnesota sites and lots of North Dakota sites. We had 25 of 28 of those correlations with those fields over those 3 years. The satellite image was correlated with our soil nitrate levels. So it's a very good tool. Right now, AgVice Laboratories are our largest laboratory in the region. Reported that their zone soil samples from their zone sampled fields now outnumbered those from the conventional uniform application type fields. And then satellite imagery is a very common tool for growers to use. So we're looking for improvements right now. We need a better estimate of the end credit, but also we need some help trying to figure out the in-season nitrogen needs. We haven't investigated that a little bit. We have restrictions because of our climate and doing the same kind of things they do in Oklahoma. To do an immediate top dress because we don't know whether it's going to rain or not. But we do have issues with wheat because of the protein premium that we get from the hard red spring wheat and the durum. We need to know what kind of level of nitrogen is in the plant that might trigger a post-anthesis application of nitrogen for protein enhancement. And right now we don't have that trigger. You know, we just don't know. We don't know what to tell them. So we're going to be looking at Green Seeker, hollow crown per circle sensor, trying to calibrate that with satellite imagery, perhaps, to try to figure out where that trigger is, so that we could tell growers that, you know, when you get a ratio of this between your N-rich strip and with whatever's out in the field, that's the time to go. There's also some opportunities in corn and sunflowers, for example, too. We have a lot of nitrogen loss with leaching and even more with denitrification, particularly in the eastern part of the state. And so in those areas that people are thinking about side dressing, we won't need to be able to tell them that you need to do it. You know, just generally what kind of rate to think about. Right now we don't have those triggers, and we're hoping that either the satellite images or the optical active aquifer sensors will be able to help us out. So I've been out of this for a couple of years, but I'm back in it both feet right now with a couple of projects, and that's what we're going to try to figure out in the next few years. So we have a Green Seeker crop circle sensor. This is some work that we did with beets, and Kyle alluded to it just a little bit at the end about the 3D, but we saw a marked improvement. One of the things that we still have to work with, and maybe we can do that with something like a crop circle, is when we went out in a sugar beet field that was gridded and tried to estimate from the NDVI, the Green Circle reading, what the dry matter content, end content, and the total end content of it was, it was okay. But when I just had this thought when I went out there, I'm walking through there, why don't I go out with a meter stick and measure height and record it as I go along. So I did. And if you multiply that times canopy height, which give you kind of a 3D picture of what you were dealing with, then the R value was very much higher. So I think that three-dimensional type part of it really is, we haven't pursued it much since then, but I plan to next year in our continuing studies. Ground satellite, this is with the old Landsat. It gives some kind of an idea what the picture of the field is, but the ground-based sensor has a improvement because of the small-scale variability and because this was done, the farmer, Gary Wagner, Climax, Minnesota, actually put this on as beat the foliator, you know, the day, the minute that he was chopping up that foliage and putting it back in the soil. This was back in August. This is in October. This is the day he put it back in the ground. So it's, to me, that's a really, really good thing. So we have a lot of nitrogen loss up in the northern plains, and we hope that this will help out as we go along. So with that, maybe not?
Yep.
Question right here? I'm sorry.
Repeat the question.
Try the chlorophyll meter, manage sugar beet, nitrogen, or durum wheat, grain crops. Spad meter.
Oh, the spad meter. Yeah, the question was, well, I use a spad meter for those things? And the answer to that is I refuse to do that because no consultant would ever do that. So I do not do that. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do anything that I don't think the farmer is going to do. I reluctantly, because a farmer begged me to, did a basal stock nitrate test on some of our N-rate plots for corn. But that's another one. Being in an industry for 18 years, ain't no way I'm going out there and cut stalks off.